This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill at its lowest price ever and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first and only GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Based on advertised cash price for 30-day supply of medication only. Membership required. Fee not included, and billed separately. Weight Loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's doing well. I'm taking some time just to relax. I've been on the road quite a bit and working on reports. I did some math the other day, and I was figuring to myself, how many hours on average am I spending with every single client? And this is the one thing that I would ask you all to consider. The amount of effort that I have to put in post-client review is tremendous. I cannot fathom working from one client to the next and retaining all that information and putting a plan together instantaneous. I could draw a plan up, you know, the minute that I left the property, but there's a lot of analysis that I still have to do. I have to look at the volume of biomass on that landscape, you know, what areas need to be worked and making sure there's kind of a semblance of organization to the design. So I can later talk to a client. It just doesn't take an hour to sit there and design. I spend anywhere between 30 to 36 hours with most of my clients, their total time to design. And that's pretty significant considering I think there's other folks that just go to these properties, you know, quickly do a back of the envelope and leave. And You know, that's the type of quality work that I want to employ and should, you know, I think that should be a staple in the industry. That being said, you know, my investment, right? I'm trying to invest in the clients, invest in the outcome, invest in the solutions, and that takes a lot of thinking on my part. I was asked recently, should I choose perennials or annuals for my food plot? And I said, why not both? Why not have the boast of both of best of both worlds, where you have annuals and perennials adjacent to one another? You have a system of rotation where you're attracting deer all through the season and you do not have any gaps. Why not have both? And I think that's a staple in my food plot designs and something that I would recommend for everybody. I'm not suggesting you can't just have annuals or you can't just have perennials, but why not have the best of both worlds? So on this podcast, I wanted to kind of go a different direction, and it's probably something unique to all of you and something that maybe many of you have not considered. And I realize that we all think differently about things, and I've kind of gone on the route of natural processes and natural solutions for a landscape. The more and more I don't know if it's a maturity thing or me getting more seasoned as I look at the world, but as I look at what I want to do in my landscape, I realize two things. I have to put more physical effort into doing some of the particularities. I'm building a system on my new property. I call it forest synchronization. And it is daunting, the amount of physical labor required for this. And this is something that I would like to, you know, eventually demonstrate and highlight for people, because, you know, some of the designs that I'm coming up with personally are closed systems loops. We're not adding any fertility. Somebody asked me recently, they said, well, what do you do in your forest stands? I said, well, most people burn forest stands, but in our areas, because of the permitting options, we can't do that. But are there natural ways to improve your forest stand that will increase fertility in the landscape to create more attraction for deer? And I said, yeah. And everyone else goes blank. Like, well, how is that even possible? There is a process that I'm now employing on my property and my design that is going to increase natural fertility and as a result attract more deer. And that's very unique to thinking about landscapes. You know, if you're just applying something as a remedy and hoping that one thing fixes the entire system, that's not looking at the big picture. And we want to have big systems pictures approach or a big picture approach to looking at our landscape. And again, these are not simple things. The landscape is far more complex than our brains. And so it's hard to put all the pieces together. We find problems and we try to figure out solutions, but we don't look at the big picture on maybe how an entire system or entire system solution will resolve. These are some of these products that you're seeing people throwing in the ponds. They're adding, you know, to the landscape, and they're fixing things. But how about some natural remedies? How about ways that we can add some inputs to our landscape where we get fertility benefits, we get disease benefits that are going to help our crops? And there's kind of like an allopathic kind of mindset, but there's also, you know, there are things that have been practically done for years that we've looked over. One of the best examples, and I've used this with multiple clients, is we have powdery mildew. We have disease, a lot of fungal diseases and airborne type diseases in and around our plants. And, you know, these diseases attach to these plants and, you know, we run into issues. One example is a lot of times on my apple trees or adjacent plants, I see powdery mildew. And that could be have a lot to do with the environmental conditions as much to do with the plant itself. But having strong, healthy plants with a good immunity system is what's going to allow that plant to sustain and not succumb to a disease issue, et cetera. So a couple things I want to just talk about today is how do we create a landscape where we're improving fertility, we're adding some inputs, and we're not breaking the bank. Fertilizer is expensive. Some of these fertilizer options that I see that are organic are anywhere between $100 to $250 for a 50-pound bag. That's pretty darn expensive. So are there things that we can do to the landscape that will improve the fertility but don't break the bank? And one of the first things that always comes to my mind is milk. You know, if you can get in your hands raw milk, and there's a whole bunch of different processes around this, but just keeping it simple, just getting raw milk two, three, 4 gallons of milk. And that's pretty much what I apply. It's usually a 1-to-10 ratio, a minimum 1-to-5 ratio, but milk to water ratio, where we're doing some soil drenching or foliar spraying of milk. I'm like, well, why would you use milk? Milk is a powerhouse. It produces a ton of calcium. Our soils lack calcium. And effectively, it adds protein and enzymes and beneficial sugars. And so when you apply milk, you're not just feeding the plant, you're feeding the soil. There's lactobacillus bacteria and other organisms in the milk that break down organic material and make minerals more available to the plant. And so one of the things I do on a no-till system, and I'm actually in the midst of finalizing my machine. I'm building a drenching machine. It's really going to be cool. You'll see that at my masterclass, is adding in natural ways to help the system function better. So milk could be great for foliar sprays to prevent powdery mildew. And that could be in your gardens, that could be on your fruit crops, etc. And the proteins in the milk, when they're exposed to like sunlight, they have almost an antiseptic effect. And I never use milk, like I don't take milk and straight apply it. I always break it down with water. I like that 1-to-5 ratio or 1-to-10 ratio, kind of in that range. And I put it in my big sprayer. I have a 300-gallon sprayer, and I can drench the soil in all the areas. And that's one application a year. I like to do that just before the wet periods, and our wet periods are usually in August. And sometime in July, that's when I would apply that. Usually apply it in the mornings, and that usually works really, really well for me. And I'll spray it on the adjacent plants, and hopefully there's a rain coming for the drenching in the foliar system. I preferred a little more humidity on the plants, so it stays kind of in and around the plant and in itself. So that's kind of the tactic that I use. One of the other products that I use is molasses, unsulfured molasses. I've been using that for years, and it's a really, what I think of molasses, I think of as an energy resource. So milk has a lot of protein, aminos for the plant, but molasses has energy. It's a sugar resource, and it's very like a dense source of carbon that has a bunch of trace minerals in it. And it's a fire starter. It gets the bacteria moving in the soil, and it usually feeds the microbes and allows the plants to start, or allows the microbes to start breaking down the phosphorus and the nitrogen that's likely locked up in our soil. So in my areas, that's my soil starter, because I have phosphorus in the soil that's unavailable to the plant. And if I'm not adding phosphorus in a synthetic form, these are the ways that I kick it off. On average, I'll do a mix of 1 gallon to about 1 gallon of molasses to about 50 gallons of water. That's kind of my ratio. It's a 1-to-50 ratio. I've seen people do 1-to-10, 1-to-20. I do about 1-to-50. And that's really kind of what I've used over the years. I've seen 1-to-100. I don't want to provide direct recommendations to everybody, but if you really want to try to figure out, here's a natural way to increase the functionality of my soil, I'll play with some of these, variations in ratios to see how the plants respond. And really, it's a really cheap and easy way. The other nutrient that I focus on, the micronutrients that I focus on, is a broad spectrum. I use sea salt in most of the landscape. So in portions of our properties where we may do a lot of work and there's a lot of exposed vegetation, the sunlight is apparent to the ground, sea salt will be one of my number one selection choices. And there's variations on where you get sea salt. There's a lot of options out there, and my clients know what types that I use. But that could be in a ratio of 10 to 50 pounds an acre, depending on your soil type, the rain, the related precipitation timeline. Those things are kind of meaningful when using sea salt. Another foliar that I use is kind of an emulsified seaweed and kelp. And so you could go to places across the U.S. and get seaweed and then emulsify or process it, but it's a lot easier just to buy it. And the cool part about the combination of both those, it's kind of like a micronutrient buffet. So you've got nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and at least, you know, 40 to 70 micro or trace minerals in those. And these are the natural growth hormones. They help a plant sustain things like heat and drought. And, you know, if you're going to take seaweed directly from the ocean, you have to clean it off and reduce the amount of salt. You don't want to oversalt your property, but adding sodium is a component that's important when you're trying to balance your soil. But things like liquid kelp extract, there's companies that make this. You can buy them online. I'm not going to provide any recommendations to what companies go to. I think you need to do the research on that. But these are great ways to do foliar sprays. I've been doing foliar sprays with seaweed and kelp on most of my plants in the landscape, and I've gotten a tremendous response. In my annual crops, so we talked earlier about perennials and annuals. In my annual crops, they have a predominance of grass. Those grass like oats and wheat, etc., triticale, they're really responsive right off the gate. I would apply seaweed and kelp right off the gate when the plant is starting to develop. If you've got winter hardy grasses like rye and winter wheat that have survived the winter periods, what a great way to kick off the spring period, but adding some seaweed and kelp. The other thing that we add, and this is a natural in a certain form, I actually have it in powdered form, is humic acid. And basically what it is it's really highly densified compost. It's the simplest way to look at it. I use it in pretty much all my sprays. In fact, I'll add a small amount of it to every single spray. And when the plants are mostly made of carbon, and what the carbon source or the humic acid source does, it helps grab onto minerals and hold them in a form that a plant can actually use. So if you have really sandy soils, I have a tendency to use a lot more humic acids if I'm applying it to a soil drench. And then there's liquid forms of it that are very easy to apply. You do not need a whole bunch of it, but it makes your application of some of the other elements a little bit more effective. So we've got to have one basic principle. I think a lot of times we think that more is better, and more isn't always better. Some of the ratios I explained to you can be, you know, important to consider, but sometimes, you know, I might lay off and I might do a ratio of molasses of 1 to 100. So every gallon of unsulfured molasses, I may use, you know, 100 gallons of water. And the concern is if you create misstep of trying to balance the fungal content to the bacterial content, you'll get a microbial kind of bloom in the soil, and then it ties up the nitrogen, and the microbes are busy eating all the sugars, and then all of a sudden you're going to get weed competition. And so one of the things I'm trying to, you know, just identify to everybody is I'm really not using herbicides in most of my food plots at this point. And what I figured out, and I mentioned this in a prior podcast or multiple podcasts, is that if I balance the soils, I balance the plant composition and the related biomass, and I don't run into drought issues, even if I run into heavy precipitation issues, as long as my organic material is significant, I don't have weed competition. Could you imagine having a food plot where you didn't have any weed competition? And when you do have weed competition, it's so minimal, you could hit it with a weed whacker. You could mow it. And, you know, that makes my life way more easier. If I'm building really good food plots where there's minimal work, I'm balancing the soil structure, and I'm increasing nutrient loads, you know, across the soil profile, and the plants are expressing accordingly, and I'm not getting disease, and I'm creating high attraction. One of the things I keep telling folks, like clients, is I have a smaller food plot, but the food is so nutrient dense, the animals are not eating as much. They're getting more satiated because of the balanced food plot profile. And we have, I've kind of developed, I think I'm going to do a podcast on here real soon, is I've developed basically a pretty solid system of seed selection and choices and how I'm coming up with kind of the most digestible available food resources for animals. But at the same time, I'm balancing those same resources, so not everything gets taken off the table. I don't want everything in deer food. I want there to be a balance so we get a good nutrient cycling, we get a plant exchange, you know, those type of things on the landscape. So, you know, just keep that in the back of your mind. And it's really important to realize that diversity in crop rotations is critical, and always get your soil covered, always be adding, you know, cover crops and thinking about, you know, the related biology and how we can, what we can do to improve it. Now, one of the ways that I improve biology is I use a product called EM1. It's effective microbes. And what it does in my vision is it provides lactic acid bacteria and a whole host of other bacteria that are likely to help break down some of the negatives in my soil. When we have microbes, are very competitive. They are, you know, there's certain pathogenic microbes or pathogenic nematodes that will outcompete some of the good bacterias. And when you reach out and smell your soil, it should smell like sweet, like beautifulness. And when we smell our soils and it has a rotty smell and not an earthy smell, we know that the soil, there's usually a pathogen or something we need to suppress. That's a great time to use effective microbes. Now, what I typically do is once I re-baseline my soil, I mean, I'm adding amendments and I'm balancing the soil from what we lack in the landscape and or what we lack in the soil profile, I typically add EM1 at that point in time. I'll add it once or twice thereafter, but by year three, that's not a product that I typically need to use. And it does a bunch of things. It helps, like milk sprays, EM1, it's used as a foliar. And it builds almost like a protective shield of biology on and in the soil. It helps microbes glue together soil particles to form aggregates. You've seen, hopefully, examples of really good soil that has almost like that really fluffy cake look to it. Well, improving the aggregates via the microbial activity improves its health, and it helps the microbes solubilize some of the minerals like phosphorus, making them more plant available. And again, on my property, I know there's phosphorus in there, and I've added phosphorus, whether it's bone char or soft rock phosphate. I've added that. I need to break that down and make that available to the plant. And without adding some biology to the equation, there's a much lower probability that your soil is going to function appropriately. And most of the time, it's an additive. You want to have a closed loop system where you're not adding things. But to start off where you have, like, I've been to areas where they say they have really poor soil. And I've gone to portions of New York and Vermont, the place I just was. And I've seen soils just be much more complicated with the way that the land use has occurred previously, whether it's mining, poor land practices, and these shallow soils, and we've talked about shallow soils and the negative, you have to have a good system of processing where you are setting your soils up to function appropriately. And that doesn't just start with amendments. That doesn't just start with plants. That doesn't just start with biology. It starts with all three of those in combination. Grant Woods has gotten a lot of acknowledgement in our industry for providing, and he does great in his videos, you know, providing process that he uses. I have not paid attention to him in years, but what I've always enjoyed was that he's showing you a way to fix soils with plants. But that is just a component of the process. In fact, that is the most obvious component. That is not the essential component. You need all three of those elements to function. I'm giving you answers through this podcast of things that you can add that will help that soil functionality even far greater than we used to have or would think if we just did the practices that he may employ. And that being said, you know, lift up and look at those, you know, bits of information as completely relevant to your equation, but realize it's context that matters. And so, you know, in some of these areas, you could have rocks in your soil, but you could have very healthy soil activity, as well as a lot of mineral content in between those rocks that the plants would have available to them. I'm working in the areas where there is very low soil fertility and there's, you know, poor construct or poor soil construct. throughout the landscape. And that's much harder to work in. And I've been doing this over, I think right now, I've been doing my no-till system for over 10 years. And so that was a few years before Grant, maybe 3 or 4 years before he was doing it. And so through my trial and error, I went through these really good processes of having great crop sequencing and amending soil. But what I missed was the biology. And I didn't realize that just to maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I've kind of realized that you're not getting the gains that you would expect normally. I can increase organic material through the nines, but am I processing that organic material for the plant at a rate that's acceptable? And one of the things we can start to think about is getting away from the typical herbicides. Herbicides, basically, when they exist in the soil, they're just polluting the microbial networks and the plant networks within the soil, and then essentially toxifying that system. Well, if you just have, you know, crops that you're crimping and then they're slowly dying, so a roller crimper, basically, you know, we use it a certain time of year and you have to have a certain composition of plants. But as you chop it, almost like a chopper, and you could use a flail mower as an alternative, not a rotary mower, flail mower. The flail mower is going to speed up the decomposition of that, what we call brown material on the soil surface. Well, this roller crimper, what it does is it chops the vascular system of the plant, and then the above and below material, so the root material, slowly degrades and feeds the biology. Whereas when you go to just kill a plant, the plant chokes itself out essentially with an herbicide, and now what you've done is polluted in and around that root system. And that people that are using hack and squirt and all these methods, it is a temporary means to quickly remove something in the landscape, but the use of that in a large scale or over time or many times they're over is a pollutant. It's almost as bad as putting arsenic all over the place in my mind. And that's kind of my mindset that we've had. And we had Ben Falk here on the podcast to talk quite a bit about, he's never just had the inclination to use an herbicide. And again, I'm not saying that I'm, you know, completely righteous with everything and I haven't used herbicides, but I'm trying to eliminate that. And so that's, I think, an important piece of this equation. But some of these practices that we're employing can be really beneficial. Right now, I'm building a couple things on my property. One of the things that I'm building is I'm building vermicompost bins. And, you know, you'll see this at my masterclass. And from the worm bins, essentially, I'm able to get highly nutrient-rich soil. And we're using that soil for compost teas. We're using it for foliar sprays. And it's a very easy system to drench that and utilize the output of that to increase the nutrient levels in and across our landscape. I'm making a Johnson Sue compost bin. I have other composting systems that are similar to Johnson Sue, but I'm actually building bins so they're portable. We can move them around and we can use them to add some fertility to some of the trees that I've planted on my landscape. And these systems essentially are closed loop systems. I can get all the resources pretty much from my property. And one of the examples recently, I got a relative who has a machine and basically there's a Eurasian milfoil and it grows on a local lake. And, you know, this is using resources to your advantage, just like the seaweed. You don't want to have it in a foliar spray. You want it to compost. But if you have these very active brown material composts, you add a high nitrogen resource in there, balancing that carbon to nitrogen ratio. You add a product like milfoil, which is basically just a plant that's growing in a water body, and it's going to feed and produce a ton of activity within that soil. And great to use in these compost bins, and it could be in a cold compost or warm compost bin, but even in a Bio Johnson Sue reactor where you're going to have this really rich material that you can put in and around your plants, assuming you have a good fungal to bacteria ratio, and then those plants themselves will do phenomenal. It's like a few years ago, I remember reading an article, and it was a Craig Harper discussion where he had added fertilizer to trees. And fertilizer in and of itself is not necessarily synthetic fertilizer. In and of itself is going to let certain plants function. But as a forest starts to develop, the fungal components, basically the plants themselves, are interwebbed to one another. And so adding in material that isn't in the same form or format doesn't really relate well to the plant. So adding a synthetic fertilizer to some of our larger trees doesn't work for the system. That's an ecology mess right there, because it doesn't meet the plant at what stage of life it's in. Now, some of these younger plants will benefit from synthetic fertilizers because it's feeding the system direct. They're more susceptible or able to process that in its function. They have most often a bacterial dominance, and so they're able to accept and ingest those kind of components. And so that's a lot different from a fungal dominated system. And as you start to build fungal dominance, you'll start to get the next layers of plants like brambles, etc. That's a stage where you're starting to move towards fungal dominance, you know, the shrub layer, then the tree layer, or the young forest layer and the tree layer. And so you're starting to build fungal dominance. And so synthetic fertilizers don't work in those equations. But these natural remedies and these natural resources, as well as, you know, the compost that we make, do function well in a tree scenario. So those are some things to think about on your property. So I went all over the place today. I just wanted to kind of shoot it and give you some ideas to think about. This is very different than I think what we've talked about in the past. It's things that I've used, my approach. There's several other techniques and things that I'm using in my designs, and that allows for higher plant functionality and photosynthesis. And if I can take a plant and increase the total dissolved solids, and that would be proteins and sugars and everything, and I have a tool, it's called the refractometer, I can increase the level of quality of that plant and the attraction related to that plant. I could now have a smaller food plot and a smaller resources that I have to work on. And I can get in the woods and doing things that I want to do with my, my forest management tactics and things that actually keep deer in the landscape. We always look at food as a resource that creates movement and flow on a property. But thinking about our food when a deer's diet demands is an average across a whole year, 50 to 60% naturalized woody material, natural forage, etc., will be resources that sustain the deer. And the food plot work that we do is not self-sustaining in a lot of ways. So, you know, how can we build these natural systems on our landscape to attract and hold deer? And then what natural remedies can we add with almost a closed loop system? Milk might be from, you know, maybe your neighbor, et cetera, but having these, some of these systems that we don't have to add a lot of amendments, and we get the results that we want and we get the attraction that we want, and we're doing it in a much more simpler way. And, those are things that I want to kind of leave you with. So I appreciate everybody listening. I know there's a lot in here. This is a good podcast to listen over a few times and think more in depthly about, but building systems that are natural, that meet ecosystem needs, and that function appropriately are kind of the objectives. And this is a start to that. And some of these solutions that I gave you should change your way you look at your property. All right, we'll talk next week. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.